And it is the Federal News Countdown, the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by two experts in the world of the federal government. And it is in honor of Pi Day. It's a very special Federal News Countdown. It is the all-Allen edition of the Federal News Countdown. It's Alan Schwatkin of the Professional Services Council. Good afternoon, my friend.
Good afternoon, Francis.
And it is Larry Allen of Allen Federal Business Partners. Great to see you.
Francis, great to be here.
And I apologize for no pie. We had some in the kitchen, and it's been eaten by... You never bring food to a radio station if you want it to last for very long, and it didn't do that. Now, my colleague, Nicola Grisco, also suggested that we call this today the Federal Bros Countdown, because you guys have known each other for quite a long time, and... You know, you're regulars on this program, and you know how the countdown works and all of that jazz. So we're going to dig right into it and start where we always do.
Number three.
And Alan Schwatkin, your third most important federal news story of the week is from GovExec. The headline is Senate Panel Presses OMB on Management Agenda. Now, a lot of folks were happy to see that there were at least some elements of a management agenda in the 2015 budget request. But obviously, as this story mentions, the leader of this group that wants to see more and know more about it is Senator Tom Coburn. There are a lot of folks on the Senate side that are just not quite sure where this is headed.
Well, that's right. And compliments to the administration for continuing to pursue a management agenda. And it's getting better and better and stronger and stronger and deeper and deeper. What's interesting, not only is Senator Coburn trying to probe on some of those elements, but the takeaway to me is still don't have a common taxonomy, a common understanding for what's to be covered, what's in the program, what is a program. I was amazed when the Comptroller General, in his testimony, suggested that we need legislation to define that.
Mm-hmm.
You'll recall we've had conversations back in the sequestration when I said one of the most important decisions to be made is the definition of that program, project, or activity.
Yep.
And so if we can't even know when we have a program, how strong can a management agenda be and how successful can it be?
The inventory of programs that Senator Coburn has proposed for a long time would go a long way in establishing this, and he seems to be a lone wolf on this. He seems to be the only person who really is jacked up about it. Everybody else seems to think it's not really that big a deal.
Well, I think most people assume that the management side comes along with the programs that they're funding or the activities that other elements of the government are running, and the chairman said at the committee, it's a good thing that we have a management agenda. We just need to continue to push forward on it, and it's important that the committee and the Congress pay attention to it and for a variety of different reasons.
Do you think the right people were at this hearing? I certainly General Dodaro and Beth Cobert and Dan Tangerlini were important, and their contributions to this hearing were valuable. Were there other speakers that you think should have been included here?
We missed the next line down, the next level of operations. The chief operating officers of the agencies are the ones who really have to execute, define and execute the programs. And I hope that maybe if this was the first hearing on the management agenda, to get Ms. Cobert to lay out the budget, the objectives of the president in the FY15 budget, that they'll shortly thereafter call some of those chief operating officers for the agencies that have the responsibility for identifying the programs and the activities within their agency and then executing them and find out where that support really is.
We are going about requesting interviews from the performance improvement officers at the various agencies, too, and talking about how this will fit into what they expect to do to hit these goals, to execute on these goals that the White House has set, both the goals within the agencies and the interagency goals. And I have been struck so far, at least, at the reticence, I guess, is the best word I can think of, at the agencies being ready or interested in talking about the progress that they may or may not be making.
And I think that the metrics to show that progress are still elusive. They're still hard to identify and hard to measure and therefore hard to report on. And I think that may contribute. It's not something that gets solved overnight. It takes constant attention from the top. We clearly see that from the president, clearly see that from Beth Cobert at the Office of Management and Budget, and need to make sure that that stays at the top of the agenda throughout the departments and agencies as well.
Charlie Clark's story from GovExec is Alan Shvatkin's third most important federal news story of the week. The headline, Senate panel presses OMB on management agenda. Larry Allen, your third most important story is from Jack Moore on federalnewsradio.com. The headline is, budget seeks largest increase in federal civilian workforce since 2009. And Jack's story is factually correct, but I wouldn't say it's probably a really great selling point to helping the president get his budget through the way he has written it, especially on the House side.
Well, not in an election year, Francis, not when you have all the members of the House up for re-election and one-third of the Senate, and everybody's looking at curtailing government spending, and as we just talked with Alan about sound government management and a management agenda, increasing the size of the federal workforce would seem counterintuitive. However, you know, you take a deeper look at some of these numbers, and you see that the bulk of the increase is really in two agencies, and that should give people some reason for pause. One is the Securities and Exchange Commission, and the second is everybody's favorite, the IRS. So it's fairly clear that the administration wants to increase oversight in the financial and taxation realms to drive more government revenue and perhaps catch wrongdoers who seek to skirt the securities laws in the country. I thought that was an interesting telltale sign. If you look at things like the Department of Defense, for example, that's a well-publicized decrease in the overall level of staffing. So, yes, it's an overall increase, and I think that's very telling. But what's really particularly telling is where that increase would be.
Yeah, the percentages that you point out are really the only major ones. There's a 5.9% increase in the Commerce Department. Beyond that, it's pretty straightforward. As you just go down the list, no change, up 1.3%, down 1.3%, down 3.2%, up 2.9%. It looks like a lot of fine tuning in most cases, except for the ones that you outlined, Larry.
It does. And, you know, one of the things that jumped off the page at me, as I'm sure probably did for Alan Shvatkin, is that we're not really talking about increases in areas that are close to our hearts, like the acquisition workforce, where, you know, we've had a substantial amount of decline, not just in the numbers of the acquisition workforce, but in the level of experience overall. And that's the type of experience that doesn't come overnight, Francis. It's a real part of how the government manages its money well, not maybe as headline-grabbing as increasing the number of Treasury agents, but certainly important nonetheless for managing federal expenditures correctly. So I think that if we are going to be looking to see increases in the workforce, maybe a few more contracting officers would have been in order.
Larry Allen's third most important federal news story of the week on the Federal News Countdown is from federalnewsradio.com. The headline, budget seeks largest increase in federal civilian workforce since 2009. It's Jack Moore's story, and it's up along with all of our other Countdown stories at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. When we come back, the second most important federal news stories of the week is selected by Larry Allen and Alan Shvatkin on the Federal News Countdown. We'll be right back. Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by Alan Shvatkin and Larry Allen, and we are up to
number two.
The second most important federal news story of the week is selected by Larry Allen's from FCW. It's Frank Kunkel's story headlined, Shared Services Could Save Government $28 Billion. And I don't think anybody debates that, Larry. It seems to me at this point in time, the big debate is over whether you can actually talk the agencies into doing it. I mean, some agencies are doing it within their own borders, so to speak. But to go outside the stovepipe is still proving to be a pretty big challenge, isn't it?
Well, it certainly is a big challenge outside the stovepipe, Francis. And depending on the stovepipe you're talking about, even inside. Department of Homeland Security, for example, still has officials who would like to be able to standardize on their physical floor of their building, mm-hmm. let alone department or agency-wide. Not picking on DHS, that's just an example. But that's one of the reasons why this story intrigued me. We've been getting a lot of play in the media and at the CIO Council in the federal government about shared services. This was an administration management priority that when they came out with their budget request for FY15. It was right there at the top. So it's been something that's been getting a lot of talk at the senior leadership level, and there certainly is a potential for savings there. But I kind of come back to the default where you were in the introduction, which is we're going to be running against an ingrained, not invented here culture in a lot of agencies. No matter how well we do something in one government agency, there's very little incentive right now for another agency to pick that up and say, yes, they can do it better than we can, because, you know, that could mean full-time employee counts. That could be a budget hit on that agency. And that's not how you make a career for yourself in government management right now.
Now, Larry's point, I think, is well taken, Alan, about the not invented here idea. I talked not too long ago to a CIO, a bureau-level CIO at an agency that is pushing shared services very hard, and asked him about what's the status of shared services within your bureau. And he says, yes, we're very excited about it. We're happy to provide shared services to all the other bureaus inside our agency. And I thought, well, that's not really what the guy at the top of the organization has in mind. He's thinking about this a little differently than you are. But I think that's a good example of where some work still remains to be done.
Well, very much so. And there's still a challenge in identifying what the right shared services is. It's easier to talk about it conceptually, much harder to talk about it in down in the details. It's hard to prove the economies out for an individual agency, as Larry suggested, that there are acquisition, there are budget issues for agencies. And until we crack the code on some of those, and there's lots of good examples of where it works within agencies, NASA's shared services for its internal activities down at Stennis Center, world-class and working very well after some early fits and starts. Other examples of the finance centers at Ag doing well. We need to build on those successes because there's simply not enough money available for every agency to do it itself. I got to tell you, companies have long since been down this path. There is less when you have a financial number in front of you, companies quickly get over that territorial approach. Larry's seen that, I'm sure, in the consulting work that he's done, that companies find a way around that shared services, outsource that relatively easily.
The report that Frank Kunkel's writing about here is a Meritalk study called Shared Services Ready or Not, and Frank does a good job of breaking out the really important numbers here. Nearly 75% of respondents said shared services are a strategic initiative for their agency CIOs. I thought that number would be higher, but there it is. 96% believe it should be. So people like the idea. The concept is fine. Just over half of agencies are using shared services. A little bit of a disconnect there. And my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, gentlemen, but my understanding is that the barriers to doing it have been pretty much rolled back. And the holdup now, you mentioned some of the things, Alan, that are things that have to be done, but they don't. None of those that you just said sound like barriers. There are things that if you say, hey, we want to do this, we want to leverage the savings, they're very doable. So it seems to me the barriers have been removed, and that number, the 96% versus the just over half, we should start to see that narrow in the not-too-distant future, shouldn't we?
Well, really, it has been the laws and regulations, Francis, that have been put in place that encourage some of this. I mean, you can point to a number of things, like the Economy Act, which is not a new law. It's been on the books for years, that allows agencies to share government contracts among themselves. Encouraging lower overhead is a top management priority for some of those chief operating officers. So we're really talking about a cultural change, which is so often the case in government management. To your point, the formal impediments are few, but the attitudinal impediments are the things that need to be conquered.
The respondents to this said shared services save 34% of the total federal IT budget. That's $27.9 billion. And I think if I'm looking at these numbers and thinking about this possibility, why wouldn't I want to save that money? Even if I'm not quite sure that money will be repurposed to my agency somehow, why wouldn't I want to do that just because it's the right thing to do?
I think there's a lot of questions about the reality, the truthfulness of the savings numbers.
Okay.
I mean, you can build a business case that'll tell you anything.
Mm-hmm.
And my limited experience around the shared services and watching how the federal agencies have done it is that all these savings don't always pan out. And in fact, in many cases, there are upfront investments and spending that you have to make in order to achieve that. So there is some reluctance, and when your federal agencies are often getting to the point of where public corporations are, which is a quarter by quarter, month by month perspective on the financials, and then you overlay that with some of the past budget challenges, and there may not be the financial will or the motivation to get that done when their attention is focused elsewhere.
So at some point in time, will it be necessary, do you think, for somebody, OMB or somebody, to say, this is just how we're going to do this? I mean, they're going that way now with some of the things
right.
The GSA is offering in shared services.
Well, clearly, Francis, the administration is pegging some of its budget requests numbers on the reality that some sort of shared services will be implemented for an FY15.
Mm-hmm.
And they're reducing expenditures, say, in the IT budget, banking on the fact that they're still going to be able to deliver the same or better type of service via shared services and the lowering of overhead that should come with that. But, right, I think that if you're talking about the Federal Strategic Sourcing Initiative that has told agencies, okay, you're going to be doing this, you're going to be using these multi-agency contracts, it may very well take that type of effort here.
How much pushback do you think that OMB would get from agencies if they went ahead and did that, Alan?
Quite a bit. Again, I think there are some you have to look at the functions that are going to be covered and where those real savings can come in. This harkens back to some of the initiatives in prior administration, lines of business around the payroll, around credit card processing. Those kinds of administrative functions are the easiest to do as you go up that technology stack, as you try to involve computing. Other kinds of activities, I think the pushback on the agencies gets harder and harder.
See, there's a date here that I'm looking at that I think is going to be influential in how things like this work, and that date is November 5th. That's the day after the 2014 election. And at that point in time, the job of this administration to do anything historically will become much more difficult because they, at that point, will be truly lame duck. And the Congress at that point will be caring completely about their own reelection in 2016 and not caring at all about the legacy of this administration. And so it seems that for something like this, that they put a fair amount of push behind so far. That's the date that I think if I were them, I'd be probably looking at. And I'm sure that they're aware of that.
You also consider that another date of October 1, which is the start of the federal fiscal year, when if the budgets support their activities, president and cabinet secretaries and others also have a legacy to worry about. And it may very well be that they have but a 12 months remaining
mm-hmm.
To use the funds that are made available in the budget and in the management agenda that we talked about earlier to accomplish their goals.
I just wonder what happens between now and either October 1st or November 5th that prevents us, Larry, from having this be a story on the countdown, 5 years from now about how the unrealized potential of shared services and all of that.
Well, I'm a cynic, so I'm thinking I think the likelihood of that is good.
The second most important federal news story of the week is selected by Larry Allens from FCW. The headline is Shared Services Could Save Government $28 Billion. Alan Shvatkin, your second most important story of the week is my colleague Jason Miller's story on federalnewsradio.com. Technical and data issues continue to plague vendor performance databases. And this is something that vendors have been fighting for a long period of time. And Senator Claire McCaskill now is extremely frustrated by the Federal Awardee Performance and Integrity Information System and the Past Performance Information Retrieval System and the capabilities therein. Do you think she's right to be frustrated, Alan?
Well, she absolutely is, but maybe for different reasons than came out in this was a hearing. And Jason's lengthy and largely accurate story points to some of them.
Wow.
I had to say that.
And that's fine. That's what the show's about.
So vendors, companies have as much interest in past performance. It was really Steve Kelman in the last century who pushed through the use of past performance in future source selections. And he's got great stories about his children, Chuck E. Cheese and everything. And if you haven't heard them, you're lucky.
Wow.
So,
well, you're on a roll today, man. You're all fired up.
I'm ready for spring. Opening day is just a couple of weeks away.
Thank God.
So it's important for vendors. It's important for agencies to have this information right. And Senator McCaskill's concerns about the way the databases that are available to the government are operating is still not where it needs to be. There were some early decisions made about how to structure the database, not to invest in brand new, not to throw out what we had, but to use what we did have. And over time, there's been a number of changes. As she, again, thinks that this is a single ubiquitous database that covers all behaviors of everybody. It is a contract database. It measures performance on a contract-by-contract basis. And so some of the concerns that she raised about why certain companies are listed or not listed just isn't what the database was designed to do.
Mm-hmm.
It's important for due process. There are some other changes that need to take place. So good issue, important to the entire acquisition community, both government and contractors. We ought to join in collectively to get it right.
It seems in 2014, Larry, that the things that she's concerned about are understandable, but there's got to be a more streamlined way that this data can be made available to the people who should see it.
Well, a streamlined way, Francis, that's right, across platforms, interoperability, open source, things of that nature are all important to making this work. But so, too, is not placing on federal agencies a succession of new data collection requirements and reporting on things that may or may not have any significant impact on core contract performance. So, you know, what I'm saying here is that perhaps Congress can hold a mirror up to itself. They keep somewhat changing the target here and requiring agencies like GSA, which does not have a broad bandwidth of IT people to work on creating new things out of whole cloth, you can't really expect them to perform on this type of thing because they just don't have that capability to do it. So I think that there are certainly a lot of barriers inside the agencies. Different data, as Alan said, is collected for different things. But part of it is that we've never really been dealing with a static amount of information to begin with. And the FAPA system, the Federal Awardee Procurement Integrity System, is a prime example of that. That's only, 4 years old?
It's not very old.
Right.
One of the elements that Jason reported on in this story that I did think seems like it should be a pretty easy fix and yet was a little egregious at the same time. This is Senator McCaskill. We have Lockheed Martin Corporation, which is apparently different than Lockheed Martin Corp without a period, Lockheed Martin Corp with a period, Lockheed Martin Corporation, Lockheed Martin Corporation, Lockheed Mar. And she listed all of these various permutations of Lockheed Martin. On the one hand, that's understandable, but Jason did point out, as you said, Alan, in this lengthy and largely accurate piece, it's entirely possible that in a situation where an agency is looking for information about past performance, one particular part of a company, I'm going to pick it on Lockheed, performed admirably, and another separate, totally separate part of a company didn't, and it wouldn't be fair for that company to have them all lumped together. So that becomes another layer in this, it seems to me.
This is a multi-level chess game, and I don't mean it as a game that you're trying to move pieces around, but
right.
Large corporations have old divisions, long-standing divisions, new divisions through acquisition, spin-offs, and so tracking the family tree, if you will, becomes a real challenge. There's some efforts underway to do that. But some of the tools that we've used in the past may not be the most flexible. Yet, as Larry suggested, we've been collecting that data, and we can't just throw it away and start over. I think that would be a bigger mistake. So we need to make the systems as accurate as we can make them, as flexible and as fungible as we can make them. But there are always going to be limitations. We just ought to acknowledge it and not criticize the government agencies or the contractors because the database isn't perfect.
All right. We only have a minute or so left, but when you throw it out on the table like that, I have to ask, what did he miss? Largely accurate, come on. I'm teasing you, I know. But,
I know that.
But what wasn't here that you would have liked to have seen?
Well, I think there's the other layer here are the changes that are coming. Last November, a set of regulatory changes put into place around collection of information, some proposed rules around due process. Those are the things that clarity around what this database was really designed to collect. So it's not so much that he was wrong, but I think there is a piece of this story that wasn't really told completely, and so it just leaves the impression that it's another government system that isn't working right, and somebody's head ought to roll for it.
Lengthy and largely accurate is the description. I love that. I'm gonna archive that on federalnewsradio.com. Alan Schwatkin's choice for the second most important federal news story of the week is Jason Milner's piece, Technical and Data Issues Continue to Plague Vendor Performance Databases. And you can find it and all of our choices on this week's Federal News Countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. The most important federal news story of the week, as selected by Larry Allen and Alan Schwatkin, next on In-Depth with Francis Rose. Welcome back to In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. This week's Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Larry Allen of Allen Federal Business Partners and Alan Schwatkin of the Professional Services Council. And we are up to
number one.
The most important federal news story of the week is selected by Larry Allen from NextGov. It's Bob Bruin's story headline, VA is competing for the Pentagon's electronic health record contract. And Bob's story, no doubt, is reported accurately, and the information contained therein, Larry, is accurate. I would not use a qualifier, as our friend did on Jason's story. But, my first response when I saw this was, this ain't going to happen. There's no way. Good for VA for getting in there, but they don't have a snowball's chance of getting this contract, do they, Larry?
Well, I think that's exactly right, Francis. It's good for Secretary Shinseki to be able to get up and talk about the VA being agile and being competitive with the private sector and trying to go after an important electronic health records project that the VA and DOD were supposed to originally do together. But this is going to fail on so many levels, which is why I thought it was a great number one story to talk about. First of all, we have the rivalry between two government agencies, the VA and DOD, which, as I just mentioned, have tried for the last several years to work together to set up a common electronic health record database and just made the decision a few months ago that they weren't going to be able to do that. Right now you have the agency-to-agency rivalry, but you also have the specter of a government agency competing for business with private sector integrators, which raises all kinds of interesting discussions about government competing with industry and whether or not that is kosher given some of the A76 OMB management guidelines. A lot here to talk about, a good headline-grabbing story, but I'm not sure that there's going to be any there.
It seems to me, Alan, if the Defense Department had any intention of using VISTA at all, if they were interested in it at all, if they saw any potential in it at all, they would have gone down this path a long time ago. And this is Secretary Shinseki making a valiant effort, but I don't see it being anything more than that.
I'm not an expert at all in the health healthcare area or the electronic health records issues. But as Leah suggested, I think this is fraught with problems, everything from the access to information to the bidding strategy to post-award accountability. We talked about Mrs. McCaskill and past performance. What do you give VA as past performance? How do you rate them compared to others? The experience in this government private sector competition is too long and too ugly to start down again. If they've got a solution, bless them. DOD ought to evaluate it fully. I think they have in the past. which is why they're looking to go a different direction.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly my thought, is that they probably have done their due diligence on Vista to their satisfaction, which is why this situation exists in the first place. And the idea that the Department of Veterans Affairs is going to come along and do something different, Bob's story says VA plans to develop an advanced version of its Veterans Health Information Systems and Technology Architecture, Vista EHR, dubbed Vista Evolution. That's great. I don't mean to sound like I'm disparaging that. It's no matter how great it is, that rivalry, Larry, that you mentioned earlier, whether that's the issue or whether it's a usability issue or whatever it is, it seems that DOD's made up their minds, and no matter what it is that the VA does moving forward, it's going to be very difficult, it seems to me, for them to change it.
I think that's right, Francis, and I think you have to dial this back to the original reasons why it wasn't possible for DOD and the VA to come together on a common system. And certainly there was a host of turf issues and infighting, things of that nature. But also, you do have agencies that, while they're related in terms of the constituency they serve, there are differences. The VA gets veterans after they have served their country, and they have special disability issues that DOD doesn't have. On the other hand, DOD has issues that they have to deal with younger active duty people that have different health care needs, different expectations from what veterans have. So, you know, it on the surface, while it may seem like there's some good meshing, when you drill down into it, it's really not. I mean, there is some overlap because there is some commonality in the universe of people being served, but you're catching them at totally different points of their lives with totally different needs, and I just don't know that it's going to be possible for the VA to put a system in place that serves DOD while at the same time the VA still is able to take care of its core constituency, which is the veteran. Even though the VA has seen a double-digit increase in their IT budget, for example, they still have limited resources, and they still have a core mission to fulfill. And I think there are probably a lot of people in Congress that would like to have questions answered on how they're going to make VISTA work properly for veterans before they seek to expand that service out to other government agencies.
So here's a what if. So let's say VA goes after this contract and they don't get it. Can they protest? Can one agency protest on an award to another that another agency does?
Under the specialized rules, Larry mentioned the A76, the competitive sourcing. The Congress changed the rules to permit a government offeror under that unique program to challenge an agency decision. Yes.
So that, I mean, and then that takes us back to this rivalry issue, Larry. This has the potential to get really ugly if outcomes that people want don't happen and somebody decides to pursue this kind of a thing.
Well, certainly, and beyond the appeals process, just for the sake of discussion, let's say the VA won. As Alan alluded to earlier, how do you ensure performance? How do you ensure program oversight throughout the lifetime? What happens when the VA falls short? Who decides that? Which agency's IG? Which congressional oversight committee gets to make that call, fraught with all kinds of issues?
Larry Allen's most important federal news story of the week is from NextGov. The headline is VA is competing for the Pentagon's electronic health records contract, and you can find it and all of our countdown stories at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. We'll wrap up this week's Federal News Countdown with Alan Shvatkin's choice as the most important federal news story of the week next on In Depth with Francis Rose. Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by Larry Allen of Allen Federal Business Partners and Alan Shvatkin of the Professional Services Council. And Alan, your most important federal news story of the week happens to have the Professional Services Council in the headline. That's a great selection on your part. Okay. Professional Services Council brings tech companies further into the fold.
And, you know, I've been very fortunate to be invited back many times. This may be the last time.
Despite the fact that you plug stories that you're in, that's okay.
And I generally don't plug stories that I'm in personally, although the association is.
But, well, that's Soloway. I forgot about that. I'm sorry.
But the reason for highlighting it is that we've created this tech council, but to really show how rapid the pace of change is in the government around technology and convergence now. We've moved from products to products and services to solutions, and now to almost a consumer model, consumerism model as a service. And so the real question for the Tech Policy Council that we've formed for the government is, how do we compete in that marketplace when the vendors are offering this as a service model, the government wants to buy it for savings? And are we really structured? Do we have the right rules in place? Do we have the capability and the knowledge to do that?
How much of this has to do with the turmoil that is going on in the advocacy community, separated from what you're doing now?
Very little of this. We've been at this technology issue for quite a while, and our board of directors last June started that process, asked us to do a lot more in December. What other associations are doing has very little to play at it. Where we've been asked to participate in any number of initiatives, whether they be acquisition reform in the Defense Department or IT reform, working with GSA on their contract management models for services, all of this is looking at the new way that vendors are offering and buyers are buying services. And even our own internal traditional model for looking at that is getting out of date. And if we're going to stay relevant in the marketplace, and if our companies are going to stay relevant, we have to be ahead of the curve, and that's what we're trying to do here.
This reminds me, Larry, I think what Alan says, first of all, about the way that the business is morphing and the specialties are morphing and converging is very true.
Largely accurate.
To July Toro's credit, though, this piece is not as lengthy as what Jason wrote. This is only 2 pages when you print it out on paper. But the idea that the fill in the blank as a service is kind of morphing with the IT world seems to be right on target to me.
Well, it is right on target, and it's an interesting point that Alan makes. And just earlier this week, I was in a meeting where there were a group of Cisco officials and some of their industry partners, and I thought it was notable that, you know, Cisco is known as a hardware company, and they're famous for their routers. And what the official from Cisco was saying was that in a few years they want to be known as a great software platform provider, which is indicative of the type of change that they see going mm-hmm. on in the technology market, and I think speaks to the fact of why Alan's Association, Professional Services Council, would seek to expand out a little bit, because we're getting a whole new group of companies that are classifying themselves as service providers. That's the way both the federal and commercial markets are going.
That's exactly where companies that traditionally were hardware companies are staking all their bets, it seems. I mean, Hewlett-Packard has just done that. I had Marilyn Crowther on the program yesterday from HP talking about their service business. Dell has bought a couple of companies within the last, two or three years,
yes,
where that have gotten them very heavily into the service. Services business. All of the major companies are doing this. What does this look like in 5 years, do you think, Alan?
Well, I think primarily we'll move from a heavy investment in equipment, sometimes referred to as the capital mm-hmm. expenditure, CapEx, to an operational expenditure, an OpEx model, where you buy what you consume. And the pace of the risk and liability is on the vendor almost wholly to make sure that the equipment, the services, the service level agreements meet the desire. The one area to watch out for from a government standpoint, and we've been talking about that, is the proprietary products. Because, as you know, once you're locked into a product, Vista or whatever it is, once you're in there for good. And so you've got to be, that's the big issue to be careful about.
We only have about 20 seconds left, Larry. The ideas that Alan is talking about, do the vehicles exist for the agencies to be able to get the stuff that Alan is talking about into their agencies and leverage it?
Not in as large a number as a traditional IT contract does, Francis, but I think we're starting to see the government move in that direction, particularly with the advent of GSA's OASIS program.
It's good to have both of you on the countdown, gentlemen. Thank you very much. Alan's most important federal news story of the week is from the Washington Business Journal. Professional Services Council brings tech companies further into the fold. You can find all of our federal news countdown stories at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon.